Hi, I'm Jeremy Stahl. I'm Slate's jurisprudence editor. Ordinarily, I edit our courts and legal coverage from the comfort of my home office in Los Angeles, but for the next month and a half, I will be locked in a lower Manhattan courtroom with the rest of the press, a jury of 12 New Yorkers, Justice Juan Merchan, prosecutors, Trump's defense team, and the former president himself as history unfolds. I've temporarily moved myself and my family from Los Angeles to New York to cover this case firsthand, like I have done in other cases, including the Paul Manafort case, the Roger Stone criminal trial, and Donald Trump's first impeachment. I'm hoping that my background knowledge of the many, many criminal travails of our former president can offer something to you, Slate's listener. Over the next several weeks, you'll be hearing from me on Amicus, Slate's legal podcast, and in articles on Slate.com. From the jury selection to the opening arguments to the witness testimony and cross-examination and the prosecution's case and the defense's case and ultimately to a final verdict. We will be providing you wall-to-wall coverage throughout the entirety of the trial as it unfolds from the courtroom. There's no way I'd be able to do it without the support of Slate Plus. So if you're not already a subscriber, please join today by clicking try free at the top of the Amicus show page on Apple Podcasts or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen. Thank you so, so much.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello and welcome to the Slate Political Gabfest for December 22nd, 2016, the How Bad Could 2017 Be Anyway edition. I'm David Plotz of Atlas Obscura. John Dickerson of Face the Nation, you are here in the studio with me. John, hello.
I am here. Hello.
John is prepping to head out, so he's less formal today than he might be. He's very casually dressed.
I'm wearing just a hospital gown.
A cardigan.
In front of
very
a fireplace.
Mr. Rogers. That chime-like voice in the distance, that was Emily Bazelon, of course, of the New York Times Magazine. Hello, Emily.
Hello, David. And hello, John.
You stayed at my house this week, but I was not there. Did you have a nice time?
I know. I had such a nice night. You know, there were girls baking in your house, and I have no girls in my house, and nobody but me bakes. It was very charming. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, Hannah said you guys had a good time, but I was...
We did.
Meanwhile, in New York... On this week's Gabfest, it is our last regular episode of 2016. Next week, you'll have our special conundrum show with a surprise guest. There's a surprise guest on the conundrum show. So listen for that. But we're going to use today's episode to look forward mostly to a very uncertain year ahead. First, just when you thought, oh, the world can't get really any worse, it got worse this week. The attack in Berlin, the assassination of the Russian ambassador to Turkey. What is the world that Donald Trump is about to step into as our president? Then we'll look at the domestic situation. What is it that Trump faces and is likely to do on the domestic side? What is the three-sided conflict between Trump, the congressional GOP, and the congressional Democrats going to look like? How is it going to play out? What issues are going to be top of mind and top of the agenda? Then we will look at what the hell is going on in North Carolina, what is happening in that state. That's not really a look forward to 2017. That's just a look at wow, whoa, wow. Plus, we'll have cocktail chatter. And for Slate Plus, is it okay for Ivanka to be the first lady? If you are not yet a Slate Plus member, go to slate.com/GabFestPlus. Events that have become gruesomely familiar, an ISIS sympathizer, apparently, drives a truck through a crowded street market in Berlin, killing 12 people. Another ISIS sympathizer, probably, assassinates the Russian ambassador to Turkey as a protest against the war in Syria. It was strange to me how ordinary all of this felt. There's another truck attack, another murder, more ISIS. Donald Trump is going to inherit a world that feels uglier than it has in a long time. Fortunately, when things get ugly, there's one man to call. That's Will Dobson, the chief international editor of NPR, our former colleague at Slate. Welcome back to the neighborhood, Will.
Hi, David. It's good to be back, although you never call me at nice times, good times. That's always when I see the news get dark, I think, oh, David's going to call.
That's right. That's right.
So, no puppies and flowers for you.
How does it feel to be back in the old office? Did you ever work in this office?
But it's not the old office.
Yeah, I worked in this office for about 1 week. Yeah. And so, you know, it's good. So I don't feel the deep nostalgia from the old office, the old haunts. So, but it's nice to be back.
All right. Well, what was the purpose of these two separate attacks?
Well, they're, you know, I think, first of all, you have to start with the fact that they're completely distinct and separate attacks. In the case of Berlin, as ISIS's control of territory in the Middle East shrinks, what we know about past insurgencies in the world tells us that groups will typically change their tactics, and those tactics will mean lashing out in other places where they can strike their enemies, their opponents. And so, in the case of Europe, as we know, it has welcomed, in some cases, had no choice in receiving hundreds of thousands of migrants in recent years. And ISIS has taken advantage of that opportunity by having at least dozens of its own recruits in this wave. It's not wholly unexpected that a possible recruit, in this case, this 24-year-old Tunisian suspect, could have struck. And at a moment that really puts Chancellor Merkel in a bind, because she has been the proponent of welcoming migrants into Germany more so than any other European leader, and the repercussions are certainly going to be felt going into 2017 in Germany and for Merkel in particular. She faces a re-election next year. In the case of Turkey, that attacker in this assassination, he told people right afterwards, you know, remember Aleppo. He was clearly motivated, seemed to be motivated by war in Syria. There's nothing, no evidence right now to suggest that he has direct ties to ISIS. What the implications there are is, you know, directly for the relationship between Turkey and Russia. And they have moved very quickly to send the message that it won't affect their relationship, that they will continue to move and work together, which is actually a sort of a change. Only in recent times have they begun to cooperate and see sort of mutual interests in the war in Syria.
John, do you think Trump's response to the attacks, first of all, what has it been? And is it in any sense different from what Obama would do under the circumstances?
Remember when the dumpsters exploded in New York? Before any official said anything, Trump was saying, well, this is an act of terrorism. It's striking to put his instantaneous responses and his predictive self-congratulation on questions of terrorism against when there's no actual evidence. I mean, so he has a hunch and he goes with it.
But he's right. He's been right.
He's been right. Absolutely. And he's proud of the fact he's been right. And now put that against the question of Russia hacking in the election. No matter the mountains of evidence, he doesn't want to believe it. And in this case, there's no evidence and he goes with his gut. So just as a kind of interesting juxtaposition to the other story we've been following up to that, if in fact what we're seeing in these kinds of attacks ratifies the idea. I mean, you don't have to ratify it. ISIS is losing territory. They're going to ultimately lose in Mosul in a couple of months or maybe a little bit longer. But that's a super hard thing for Donald Trump to fight, for anybody to fight. And his response has always been have big kinetic attacks, lots of explosions, but it's hard to kill an idea with explosions. So he's basically, I guess my point that I'm circling around here is that that the change in terrorism is happening at a time when his solutions for it, at least based on what he says publicly, are really fighting a very different kind of terrorism.
What about his call for, you know, well, I mean, it's muddled at this point, but for banning people from countries, mostly Muslim countries, where there's more of a record of terrorism, and then this whole idea of, quote, extreme vetting, which I don't really understand what that is, because I thought that the United States already did a lot of vetting.
Well, you're right. They already do.
So is there more, like, other than just keeping people out of the United States if they come from certain countries, because that would be a shift. Are there more steps that the United States could take? Like, what is Trump actually going to put into place to embody these policies? And is it a real shift, or will it just be calling by a different name something that we already do?
Yeah, it's hard to imagine having a more lengthy and exhaustive process for this, for someone to go through than we already have. I mean, at this point, given the amount of time and the amount of investigation that goes into every single case, there really is not much more that one could do than go to a total ban. It's worth pointing out that, as we know, the Canadian government has been much more welcoming of refugees in trying to make their determinations of who they should accept. They actually use U.S. data. For another government, our vetting process is considered more than enough to make the decision on. It's just that their politics are very different than our own politics right now. So,
Will, don't you think that – doesn't this attack, particularly the Berlin attack, it serves the interests of ISIS, presumably, if they carry it out, because it kills people and frightens and discomforts the citizenry of Europe. But it also serves the right-wing parties that condemn ISIS, because it promotes their idea that fear is everywhere, danger is everywhere, these people are getting us everywhere.
Absolutely.
And given that, you can answer that part of it, but given that, does anyone have any effective strategies? If you are Angela Merkel, or you're a kind of tolerant European who does want to allow a certain amount of immigration, does anyone have any good ideas for lowering the temperature and making people less fearful? Right. Are there any strategies that you've seen work over the years to make people feel this less rather than more?
Right. Well, on the solution side of it, she's a good person to focus on this, because she's the ultimate pragmatist. We've seen now, after this attack already this week, that they put through tighter security measures, greater surveillance powers. The approach in France has been very much to keep a state of emergency in a place and to allow them to use their full law enforcement powers. But the problem they face, where that might have worked a decade ago or 15 years ago, the problem is that the numbers are so great and have swelled that their intelligence agencies are overwhelmed and sometimes act in a very ham-handed fashion. So, you really have two, and you have two separate problems here. I mean, one could debate which one is greater. Is the greater problem the possibility of ISIS recruits coming into Europe in this migrant wave? Or is it actually the population you already have becoming more radicalized, which is a much larger percentage of the population in any of these countries? So, and I think to take it one step further, why would you want to have a far right government in Europe if you're ISIS? The theory would go that then you could see more restrictive policies that would come, which would then only further alienate a large Muslim population and then add to greater recruits. So, I think for some security analysts, they see that as the long-term strategy. So it's a particularly knotty problem. The best, that you can see are very sort of low grassroots efforts to integrate these communities to sort of cross-cultural understanding. But, they're very scattershot.
Just specifically to bring it back to the incoming administration, that idea of baiting, and one of the things that Henry Kissinger said in his interview with Jeffrey Goldberg was one of the big threats that he sees is a non-state actor, as he called it, but ISIS baiting Trump for this kind of overreaction. And that overreaction becomes a recruiting tool in the U.S. and in all these other places. So just that dynamic you put, Trump is moving hard on the refugee part, which is less of a present threat in the United States than this overreaction threat. So that'll be an interesting early test.
Well, I want to actually make this bigger, because we said we were going to talk about sort of the world Trump inherits. And so clearly there's, terrible things happening in the Middle East, Europe. But one of the other big shifts is in an area of the world that you're very familiar with, which is China and East Asia. And in particular, in the last few days, Trump has signaled a much more aggressive anti-China policy than certainly the Obama administration or the Bush administration before that. What is Trump trying to accomplish on China, as near as you can tell?
I think everybody is asking themselves that question. I mean, I think the Chinese are asking themselves that question. Our allies in Asia are asking that question. I think U.S. analysts don't know that. Typically, president-elects don't actually wade as much into foreign policy as president-elect Trump has during this period of time. Generally, there's a sort of a respect for to let that administration finish out its policies and then actually take over when there's a handover. But, he could also be viewing this as sort of a golden hour where he is able to send signals that could be more incendiary after January 20th. So, you know, in essence, tweak the Chinese and say you're on notice and you're going to be dealing with someone who's unpredictable if you didn't already know that. If you don't get the U.S.-Chinese relationship right, it will likely overshadow everything else. So this is maybe the biggest challenge he'll face. We focus on the attacks, and rightly so, but in terms of the relationships among states, it's the relationship between Washington and Beijing that probably matters most.
What I don't understand about the about China, Will, is when you say get the relationship right, are you talking about the economics of it? Because what I just fundamentally don't grasp about the coziness that Trump seems to be feeling towards Russia, or at least that's the perception he's generated, versus the relative hostility to China, are the trade implications. I mean, when you think about the world economy, isn't China and moving in the direction of the East much more valuable to the United States in terms of what we make and produce and how our economy could grow, then I fundamentally don't grasp that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. I mean, the costs to Trump's economic agenda of sparking a trade war with China would be immense. And so there's a question as to whether or not he's, you know, I suppose you could say playing chicken with the Chinese over something like that. I mean, but what has happened, and I think it's been even more surprising, because at least there was campaign rhetoric that said, you know, coming out of that, that he was going to take a tough approach with China. And to look back in history, you know, there's nothing remarkable about that. When you campaign for president, generally Beijing is not your friend. You know, President Clinton, the first time, the butchers of Beijing. I mean, he spent the first several years of his administration trying to walk back his promises to hold them accountable on their human rights abuses, only to really ultimately cave completely and help usher their entry into the World Trade Organization. So, in subsequent terms, it's in that way it's a consistent. But what's different here, I think, is that everyone actually believes that Donald Trump could mean it. But now, you know, what has happened in just this handful of weeks is raise questions about the security and treaty relationships that we have and with our allies in the region who are watching how he interacts with Taiwan. I mean, in Taiwan, I met with the president, I met with a number of other people in the foreign ministry, and I think it's not something that they want to talk about, but I think on the one hand, everyone believed that if you had the opportunity to have a conversation with the president-elect to really deal such a blow to your international isolation, which is what Taiwan really feels, any Taiwanese president would take that call, would make that call. But on the flip side of it is a concern of, well, to what degree is all of this just the precursor to using us as a bargaining chip with Beijing, or that they're part of the deal that could be struck and they don't want to be dealt. So right now, I mean, just going back to your question, Emily, I think just everything is on the table beyond the trade relationship.
Will, to wrap this up, is there anything that you see? You have 18 foreign correspondents for NPR. You are one of the people who are genuinely, you're looking around the world all the time. Is there anything that you see going into 2017 that should make people feel not terrible?
Oh, wow. Is there anything that is going well?
Or might go well? Like that, you think, oh, well, it could be better in 2017?
I mean, the problem with answering that question is there's more uncertainty, and I think that's what has people on edge, is that there's more uncertainty than we've seen in a long, long time. What is the relationship that seems like it's now on firmer ground than it was before? It's certainly not India and Pakistan. You know, I mean, the president-elect has shown a great interest in working with the Japanese, and they are a stalwart ally of the United States. So perhaps that's something that will make it through the buzzsaw of history. Everything is being tested.
Will Dobson is the chief international editor at NPR and longtime friend and dear former colleague. Will, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming only on Hulu. Donald Trump's election was affirmed by the Electoral College this week. He will be president of the United States with a Republican House and a Republican Senate and soon a conservative majority on the Supreme Court, as well as Republican dominance in many state houses. There is a lot of ambiguity, ambivalence, fear, confusion about what he and Republicans might do in, as they take control of national government. Is it going to be like one of the Purge movies or something? But we want to try to puzzle out what is scary, what isn't, and what is going to specifically happen on particular policies. So you have Obamacare, immigration, infrastructure, Medicare, Social Security, education reform, John. So there are lots of people ringing lots of alarm bells. What are the things that just definitely no one's going to bother with? Is there real? There's no chance they're going to take out Medicare, right?
Oh, how wrong you are, David.
Oh my
God.
Well,
I think the first thing that I think of when I think of what 2017 is going to be like is that there is going to be a flood of activity for at least two reasons. Well, three reasons. One, Donald Trump promised a lot of that. Two, he and the Republican leaders in Congress believe that you have a limited window of time. This is not a new idea. You got to move fast and do a lot of stuff. And three, at least at the beginning, he appears to be setting up a decentralized administration. So why does that matter? Well, it means that, say, on something like the Affordable Care Act, there will be the action in Congress, which we'll all be watching. But also, if you have an administration where all the cabinet secretaries have more autonomy than in the past, they can act and not have to run everything through the White House. So that means that at HHS, Tom Price, who is a strong opponent of the Affordable Care Act, has a lot of control over the program because of the way the law was written. He can do lots and lots of things that will be worth watching and worth covering at a very quick pace and not be slowed by the fact that maybe a previous kind of White House would say, look, you know, we're doing our work over here. Don't do something that distracts us from our main message. So just multiply that across every agency. The Trump team wants to use that to their advantage, which is essentially just overflow, just totally douse everybody in activity because that's your greatest moment of opportunity. And also because, you know, when there are 50 things happening, it's hard to mount a public opposition to 50 as opposed to if you had one like Obamacare and then you can rally and, you know, as happened to the president in 2010.
Emily, if you were a betting woman, which major policy shifts and legislative shifts do you think we'll see in the first couple of months?
Well, they seem to be intent on repealing Obamacare. What that actually is going to mean if they delay the repeal seems a lot less clear to me, but some symbolic big act around Obamacare. And then lowering taxes seems like the other strong common ground between Trump and this Republican Congress. So tax breaks that will largely benefit the wealthy seem absolutely destined, and some deregulation that unwinds the kinds of rules for businesses that may protect workers and consumers or do protect workers and consumers, but don't allow businesses to do everything they want to develop and grow. It seems like those are three obvious common areas. And then what might be more interesting will be the potential clashes between Trump's kind of populist agenda and the Republican Party, which doesn't share those goals at all. So Trump's folks were floating the idea of a tariff that could, you know, potentially set off real trade conflicts internationally. That's not something the Republicans have on their agenda. And this infrastructure idea, which I think it's so poorly defined that it's hard to talk about right now. It seems to have this big privatization streak running through it. But that's another one where if Trump did what he's talking about, you'd have a huge spending bill and a big increase in the deficit, presumably. Again, Republicans on paper, at least, don't support those ideas.
What happened to the deficit, John? as a matter of concern?
Yeah, here's I want to go back to your question about Medicare, which is tied into the idea of deficit. One thing to keep the eye on here, particularly with the Affordable Care Act, is there are things that can be done through budget reconciliation in the Congress, which requires only a majority. It's not like, say, the repeal of Dodd-Frank or the legislation they're talking about, which basically lets businesses decide whether they want to be regulated under Dodd-Frank or under a new set of rules. That'll require 60 votes in the Senate. And so Senate Democrats have an opportunity to block and slow things there. But with the Affordable Care Act and repealing chunks of it, that can be done through reconciliation, which they would be able to do basically, and the Democrats couldn't do anything to stop them. On the deficit question, this is why I said there will likely be something done with Medicare, I think. So Donald Trump actually doesn't, he doesn't really want to monkey with Medicare. He said it out loud, and also he just thinks, based on my conversations with people who've talked to him about it, he thinks it's a marketing loser. If you think of everything in terms of what markets well and what's effective policy, think of the stuff that markets well. It doesn't market well to mess with Medicare, so let's not do it. He's not concerned about deficits. Paul Ryan does have a stated desire to reduce deficits. And in the past, people have said, well, he doesn't because his plans for reducing the deficit are implausible. Well, he's now got a Senate majority and a president who will sign. So the plausibility of the things he's suggesting, things have become more plausible. So what Paul Ryan will do is say to Donald Trump, look, if you want to do this infrastructure spending, if you want to increase defense spending, for the stuff you want, let me do the stuff I want to do. And that's where creating a premium support system or vouchers or privatizing or whichever the characterizations you want to put it for Medicare come in. Because what he will say with the new director of the Office of Management and Budget, Mick Mulvaney, who is a Ryan mind meld type, is they'll say to Trump, if you want to do this stuff to create the space in the budget, you have to do all of the things we've been wanting to do for years to get at the deficit question. Now, who knows if Trump will buy that? But the fact that Ryan has his guy at OMB suggests he's at least got somebody inside the organization who sees the things the way he does. But in the Trump world, who knows what that means?
And speaking of all of those cabinet appointments, you know, the agencies, the enormous power of the federal government is something else that we need to be watching closely, because there are a lot of things that Trump and his appointees are going to be able to do without Congress. You know, executive orders, guidance letters, there are all kinds of tools that the administration has that they don't need Congress for. And they, you know, we saw this week, President Obama issued a sweeping order that eliminates offshore drilling on many of the nation's waters, picking up on what looks like a solid provision of a 1953 law that had gotten used a little bit, but not that much. There are very smart Republican lawyers will be working for the Trump administration, will be looking for those kinds of opportunities.
I want to close. I think it may turn out that it's almost less interesting what Trump does or does not do than how he does it.
What do you mean?
That the great
danger. By the way, I want to say I agree with you. But what do you mean?
The great danger. I think to me, the great danger of Trump in the long term is not necessarily any particular legislative action or even any bureaucratic action. It is this weakening of the political system itself, the weakening of the norms of democracy, the weakening of
the idea that a legitimate opposition is possible, right? That you can have an opposition, that's what we have.
And yeah. And that the idea that there are, the thing that we're seeing in North Carolina that we'll talk about in a minute is that people have stopped tending to think about the system and how the system needs to be maintained and are instead thinking about the immediate, you know, possible gain that you can get. And Trump does that in extremis. And I just worry that what we'll become accustomed to is that there's no regular functioning political system and that people sort of accommodate to that. And that's terrifying.
Can I add two more points on the norm front? There is the norms that Donald Trump will weaken or destroy. And then there will be the attractiveness of embracing him that will lead to the self-weakening of norms. So, which is to say Republicans in Congress. We've already seen it happen on Russia. The polls now show a greater affection for Vladimir Putin, not based on anything Putin has done, but simply because it's now in your rooting interest to like Vladimir Putin because the incoming president has shown an affection for him. So imagine that with policy. Because I'm going to get all the things I've been wanting to do, I'm going to allow him, Donald Trump, to do things that I privately find deeply objectionable. This is basically what a lot of Republicans said to me during the campaign. So that's the way in which he invites people to weaken their own norms. And then the other norm is the norm of reaction, which is to say that the standards and values that people have who oppose Donald Trump will, in order to stop him, will perhaps cast those aside in an effort to stop him. And so there you have another area in which people will be encouraged to weaken their norms.
Republicans have six times more favorable view of Vladimir Putin than they do of Barack Obama.
And their favorable view of Vladimir Putin has gone shooting up.
Fucking shocking.
Right? It's like shot up.
And actually, there's another great one about trade, too, which is that the Republicans' attitude, support for free trade has plummeted in the last few months. It has gone from support for free trade has gone from, you know, like 60% to 30%. Anyway.
Hey, Jon Favreau here. There's no shortage of political takes in 2024, but quantity doesn't cut it. We need a better conversation about the latest biggest election of our lives. On Pod Save America, me and my co-host cut through the noise to help you figure out what matters and how you can help. Every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday, Pod Save America is breaking down the political news that makes us laugh, cry, and snap our laptops in half. Expensive year for laptops. Make sure to check out new episodes of Pod Save America on your favorite podcast platform or our YouTube channel now.
North Carolina has undergone a tumultuous year. To tell the story briefly, by polling, this is a highly divided state, a purple state, but it's acting bloody red. Republicans have made it one of their great state-level successes, tremendous investment in local politics led by a man named Art Pope. We have talked about Art Pope and Jane Mayer's brilliant story about Art Pope in the past. Over the past decade, Republicans have won supermajorities in the state legislature. They have then used that to create very gerrymandered political maps so that Republican representation in the House of Representatives is 10 of 13 representatives are Republican in the House, even though the state is a 50-50 state. There have been major rollbacks of voting rights that have been targeted almost precision-like, with laser-like precision at African-Americans. There has been, of course, this obscene anti-gay and anti-trans law, HB2, and the fight that's been over that. So come November, Roy Cooper, a Democrat, narrowly defeated the incumbent Republican Governor Pat McCrory after a bitter fight in which McCrory used various chicanery to try to deny his own defeat. He has conceded, but he convened a special session of the legislature to pass a series of measures to defang the new Democratic governor. He wrenched control of the Board of Elections, the majority party, the governor's party, and essentially gave permanent control of it to the GOP in election years. He reduced the governor's power to appoint his own cabinet. He slashed the number of state officials the governor controls. It's been ugly. Also, yesterday, the legislature failed to overturn HB2, the anti-trans bathroom law. Emily, Republicans say, when it comes to the changes that the legislature passed that targeted Governor Cooper specifically, they say Democrats did a version of this three times before. They're total hypocrites to complain about it this time. Isn't that the case?
Well, Democrats did do some lesser version of this before in the 1980s. So there was when Jim Hunt was elected governor, he fired like 160 people. And there was a lieutenant governor who was stripped of some of his powers. And then I'm leaving one more instance out. But none of those things add up to the much more sweeping changes that the North Carolina legislature just made. And I think the most important thing to keep an eye on in all of this is voting and control over the election machinery. So the Republicans, as you were talking about, changed control of election boards. It's sort of nominally bipartisan, but really it gives Republicans control since they chair these local boards in even numbered years when elections actually take place. And then if you put that against the backdrop of the sweeping restrictions they placed on voting a couple of years ago, you see a real effort to maintain Republican and I would say white control of the state at the expense of Democratic and Black voters. And because North Carolina still has some of the protections of the Voting Rights Act, and you know that surgical precision line you quoted came from a court opinion that struck down some of the restrictions the legislator placed. It is both a racial and a political party set of questions here. And so when you think of all of that together, it doesn't just seem like, you know, politics as usual or tit for tat. It looks like this more long-term bid for maintaining power that has both a political party partisan dimension and also a racial dimension.
John, you would have thought that a lot of the kind of poisonousness of national politics would be diminished and mitigated at the state level. You wouldn't have thought there'd be so much of this kind of divisiveness at a state level. In a state, you really do have to govern. I mean, you can't not govern a state. So,
as opposed to the country, which you cannot govern the country.
That is possible. The country you cannot govern because there's a huge infrastructure that will carry forth. But that's a state, if you don't govern it, people get annoyed. Like that actually affects you day to day. Whereas they don't, they're less annoyed when the country isn't governed. Why is there such a willingness now for toxicity in local and state government? Where there didn't, I think, it used to be, but people have to live together in a way that they don't really.
Well, I don't know that there hasn't, there's been toxicity before. I think the point you might be making is you now have a split. You now have a Democratic governor and Republican legislature. So why would the Republican legislature greet the incoming governor with a big punch in the face, which would presumably make it more difficult to get things done in the future? I think the calculation is if things don't get done in the future, guess who gets blamed? The governor. And so that's fine. We'll just reelect our guy in there. It was going to be hard for him to govern in North Carolina anyway. I mean, I was thinking for a moment there about Chris Christie with the Democratic legislature in New Jersey. Even though they had incredible battles in New Jersey, there was the premise of both what Christie was trying to do in New Jersey and also then of his political pitch was bipartisanship is a good thing. Cooperation is a good thing. And we disagree. But like the goal is there was a lot more chatter about, even if it was totally phony, the idea of having a bipartisan consensus. That doesn't seem to be at play in North Carolina. And I should say, this isn't your point, but more broadly, the idea of making politics better and coming to common ground, we haven't, even just for the purposes of rhetorical, Donald Trump says unity. But barely. And he never talks about it in terms of like working. I look forward to reaching out to the Democrats and that kind of thing. It's just it's fallen out of our national conversation.
Right. He means unity under him, moving in his direction. I think that's why some of us, and oh, this is me, are fixated on the situation in North Carolina, because it looks like on a state level playing out in a even more brass knuckle way, this move in politics away from the idea of government functioning and public service and all the things you were just talking about, reaching across the aisle toward just like naked holding on to power for power's sake.
It does remind me how far we've come from George W. Bush's election in 2000, when part of his selling point was that he worked with Bob Bullock, the Democratic leader in Austin. And secondarily, when Bush lost the popular vote, they were in a real panic to show that he was going to reach across the aisle. As Ron Brownstein pointed out, Bush's first statement as a president-elect was in the Texas legislature, where he boasted about working with Democrats. That was his first signal. Donald Trump has had 9 victory rallies where he talked about how successful he was, not a single rally or symbolic effort or event to reach out to the people who didn't vote for him.
Yeah. I'm beginning to think that actually we would be a healthier country if we had single party rule in all of our states. It'd be better off that we just decide, okay, North Carolina, you're just a Republican state. And so now Republicans, you control all of it and you bear the consequences. And you'd actually have real debates within it, because the primary would become your basic lens for analyzing things. And if either state would prosper or wouldn't prosper, your major business wouldn't be fucking the other party. Your major business would be like, okay, we got to run the state. We know we're going to be elected. We know we're going to control
everything.
You mean
permanent single party? You don't mean like the parliamentary system? You mean permanent?
Yeah, basically. Like California has. Yeah. So it's like, wait, we know it's a Democratic state. We know Democrats are going to control the legislature or Oregon or something like that. We just don't need to worry about all the rest of that
stuff. But we do have this in some states. Like Kansas, for example, is bright red. And so Sam Brownback cut the state budget enormously and said that lower taxes were going to deliver all these things.
Right.
So then you're seeing the fruits of that labor. But you're saying that nonetheless, the Republicans
would
stay in power.
But then he has the consequences. Yeah.
Well,
the Republicans would stay in power, but there are consequences, and there'll be different kinds of Republicans would be voted in. And Sam Brownback will go down as a disastrous governor for Kansas, and Kansas knows this, and they're going to elect a different sort of Republican.
But why is that better than having an option of a different party as well? Like, why?
Because when you have two parties, apparently
the
new game is your purpose is just to murder the other party and blame them. This is a heuristic idea, which is single party rule likely to produce better government for states than
partisanship has
become so toxic.
You're trying to eliminate the poison of partisanship. Basically, you would be bringing within one party some of the same forces and tensions. I mean, what's crazy is that we are living in such a partisan moment that seems like a plausible idea.
Right. It's like, we should be like China. We shouldn't have real elections or real parties. It's just like that. They're so effective. No, I don't actually believe it, but part of me sort of wonders at the same time.
What is the self-respecting, at some point, these big swings in public opinion. Two things interest me that have nothing to do with our current conversation. One is presidents have a tough time moving public opinion. We've seen that. But Donald Trump is actually on what he's done for Vladimir Putin's relationship within the Republican Party. He's moved public opinion quite a big distance. So I wonder if we're going to see two different kinds of things. Donald Trump's ability to change public opinion within his own party rather dramatically on certain issues, trade, Russia, certainly lots of norms that were once considered important has already happened in the party. But then what's the actual ability to change the public mood? People talk about him as a genius, and no doubt he is in terms of controlling the news cycle. But it is still a limited genius. 6 in 10 still say they're not proud to have him as their president. I just wonder whether he'll be able to basically swing things at all outside of his own comfort zone. And the second question is, if you're a partisan, when you suddenly have new warm feelings about Vladimir Putin, and you're doing it just because you're the person that's the lead of your party, I mean, shouldn't something kick in at some point, or does that not happen? I mean, shouldn't you just say, huh, I wonder why I have these beliefs and why I've suddenly changed them? And that's true of both parties, because now everything sorts so dramatically by partisanship. I just wonder how that thought, if anybody has that thought process, or whether they just come to new opinions and
Don't you think it's important that something like Putin, how much do Americans really have, like a lot of people have such a strong, fully developed, you know, detailed notion of Vladimir Putin in the world and his relationship to the United States. And that's like a lot to have a really, right?
Yeah, yeah. I think you're exactly right. I think it's basically like, you know, yeah, I thought this one thing, now I think this other thing. It's like, I don't really, you know, do I get the mud flaps or not the mud flaps on the car? It's like, it's not really
right. And I trust Donald Trump. So if he says Vladimir Putin is okay, like maybe he's okay. Let's give it a shot. I mean, there's so much like, let's give change a chance going on in the Republican Party right now among the Republican base. It seems like they might be up for anything. And then they might change their minds also in an instant in the other direction.
Right, exactly. I don't care if they install Wi-Fi at the church I don't attend.
Hey, everyone, it's MSNBC's Chris Hayes. For the first time since 1892, we have an election in which both candidates have presidential records. It's a chance to take a hard look at what Joe Biden and Donald Trump have actually done as president. On a special Why Is This Happening podcast series called With Pod 2024, The Stakes, I'm talking to experts about the two candidates' records on specific policy areas like immigration, taxes, climate, and more. So you know what's at stake come November. Search for Why Is This Happening and follow.
Let us go to cocktail chatter when you're roasting chestnuts on an open fire and you're pondering your holiday celebrations, John, and wherever you are for Christmas. What will you be boozing with and what will you be chattering to the Dickersons about?
I will be boozing with whatever is at hand. And then my chatter is totally frivolous. But Pointer put out the best media corrections of 2016.
Ooh, that sounds so fun.
And there are some very amusing ones. Here's one correction from May 10th, 2016. Because of an editing error, an article on Monday about a theological battle being fought by Muslim imams and scholars in the West against the Islamic State misstated the Snapchat handle used by Suhab Webb, one of Muslim leaders speaking out. It is Imam Suhab Webb, not Pimpin' for Paradise 786. all right, hold on. Here's another one. An article on March 20 about wave piloting in the Marshall Islands misstated the number of possible paths that could be navigated without instruments among the 34 islands.
I remember this correction. Go ahead.
Among the 34 islands and atolls of the Marshall Islands. It is 561, not a trillion trillion. all right, hold on, one more. Correction, Boris Johnson's award-winning limerick about the Turkish president referred to Erdogan as a wanker who performed a sex act with a goat. A previous version of this article included the prompt for the poetry contest, which included a different sex act, but also with a goat.
That was awesome, John. Emily, what will you be tippling with? And what are you going to chatter about?
I am in just the wonkiest mood ever. I feel like every week I come up with something that is like not something anyone would really drink about. But I'm going to forge ahead anyway. The piece I read this week that really stuck with me is in Vox. It's by Sarah Cliff. It's called Why Obamacare Enrollees Voted for Trump. And Sarah went to Whitley County, Kentucky, and she interviewed people who are signing up for Obamacare and someone whose job it is to sign people up for Obamacare, who seemed deeply committed to improving access to healthcare, all of whom were Trump voters, just didn't believe Trump would repeal Obamacare since it was a program that they deeply needed. And that in itself, I think, was really interesting and worth exploring. But the other thing that Sarah gets across really well are the problems with Obamacare that make people frustrated with it, you know, the rising premiums, and also the sense that Medicaid is actually better, so that poorer people who qualify for Medicaid are actually better off in the healthcare game than these people with higher incomes who are having to purchase these plans on the market. It was just such a good constellation of the kinds of factors that politicians don't necessarily take into account, that people assume that, you know, Trump says he's going to repeal Obamacare. The voters believed him, but apparently they didn't. And the other thing I really like about this story is it's one of many that we should be doing right now, in which we're laying the groundwork for coming back to people in a year or two or four and finding out how they fare and whether their expectations were realized or not.
My chatter, I have a double chatter. First, the usual plots log rolling, which is that Atlas Obscura is doing a whole bunch of international trips in 2017, which are going to be amazing. We're taking groups to Bhutan and Morocco and the Amazon and Myanmar and underground Paris and Iceland and Cuba and Venice. They're going to be all really unusual and special and wonderful, strange trips. Me, I am going to go. We're doing a family trip to Iceland. So an Atlas Obscura trip to Iceland designed for families with kids. And I'm going to take my kids on that in the summer. So if you're interested in that, let me know. Check out Atlas Obscura. My actual chatter was about I got to actually pull this up for you, John, while we're talking. A guy named Roman Fedortsov. He's a deep sea fisherman who works on a trawler in the Barents Sea, according to the Moscow Times. And he is on Twitter and he posts pictures of the creatures he pulls out of the ocean. And it just makes you think like there's something crazy going on in the world. These creatures are just wrong. There are teeth where there should not be teeth. There are legs where there should not be legs. There are eyes where there shouldn't be eyes. The eyes are too big. They're too small. Maybe there are no eyes at all. Like there are wings there. There, it's just, it's terrifying. I'm about
it's
to.
It's like Mr. Potato Head of the deep sea.
Yeah. Here, John, look, take a look at this one. Look at these guys. Oh my God. Look
and
at that.
Is this just the bounty and weirdness of nature, or these are all, these are mutants?
No, it's just the bounty and weirdness of nature.
Yeah.
Look at that one. You can't even tell what that thing is.
Yeah. Yeah. These are worth looking at well before you have
this
to
one
eat.
Looks like an armadillo with a giant eye.
Yeah.
But why is it under the sea? That one has wings and glowing green eyes. Am I lying? It literally has wings and glowing green eyes.
These pictures are worth looking at. They look like some CGI practice session with
gone wrong. Look how many legs that thing has.
Yeah.
You shouldn't have that many legs. Nothing should have that many legs.
It is true. And, you know, there's something.
Or that thing. What is it?
That it looks like a shiitake mushroom gone terribly wrong.
Come on.
You know, the National Geographic every once in a while
translucent.
Will do those beautiful pictures of, you know, crazy things found 82 miles under the
these
surface.
Are
not,
these are actually Pokemon. But, these aren't even real. They're
but what,
Pokemon.
What the verisimilitude of the Twitter pictures like makes it seem even more otherworldly. I don't think that sentence actually scans, but you know what I'm saying? It's like the fact that he's taking it with his own like iPhone camera makes it seem more otherworldly than if it were in some beautifully photograph spread in National Geographic or Atlas Obscura.
I saw this on Gizmodo. We'll have a link to that. But the lesson is avoid the ocean. Do not go in the ocean.
Well, that's
but whatever you are doing. Do not go in the ocean.
Well, I mean, that's safe to say about it. Just in general, that's a norm we need to cling to.
So Donald Trump is shattering that norm too. He's like, go in the ocean.
Hey, can I log roll too? Because in addition to our upcoming conundrum show, there's a tradition at Face the Nation now in its second year, which is an end of year conversation with Stephen Colbert, which will be on Christmas Day. So set your DVRs.
Ooh, I will set my DVR.
Excellent.
Our intern is Kevin Townsend. Our producer is Jocelyn Frank. Steve Lichtai is executive producer of Slate Podcast. Andy Bowers is the chief content officer for Panoply. We're part of the Panoply Network. Our entire roster of podcasts is at itunes.com/Panoply. Our show page is slate.com/GabFest, which has links to what we talked about today. Facebook is facebook.com/GabFest. Twitter, of course, is @SlateGabFest. And email is gabfest@slate.com. Please subscribe in iTunes and leave a comment and rating. It really helps us if you do that. For Emily Bazelon and John Dickerson, I'm David Plotz. We'll talk to you at the Conundrum Show next week.
Do you ever feel like there's nothing new in the news? You know there are urgent things happening in the world around you, but all you hear is noise. That's why we made What Next? Our goal is to tell you the stories you haven't heard before, or maybe a different side to the story you thought you already knew all about. I'm Mary Harris, the host of What Next? And I love my job because it helps me cut through the noise of the news. And then I get to bring it to you. Together, we can figure out what next.